Welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. You can call me by my handle Mono. I live in Tokyo, I love video games, I love podcasting, so why not put all these things together? I wanted an outlet to discuss games I like to talk about, and also introduce cool gaming-related things from Tokyo and Japan to the world. If you love games, especially Nintendo games, Tokyo really is the best place on the planet. There's always some fun place to visit or gaming-related events being held. Last year, I went to a Mother or Earthbound exhibition that had awesome merch and even design documents from Itoi. I did have to skip out on the giant Mr. Saturn plushie, though. Sorry. A few months ago, there was also this interactive AR mini theme park called Pokemon Colors, where you did silly things like chasing Pokemon on a bike or throwing balls at a wall to catch them. These are the type of one-of-a-kind unique activities and places I want to highlight on this podcast, as well as, of course, general game impressions and news. Here's how I'm going to structure the podcast for now. I'll start off talking about what I'm playing. I will mostly stick to recent games, but I do love retro titles, and I'll definitely be highlighting those every now and then. You will hear me talk about Mario Super Picross eventually. It's my breaking case of emergency game. Like I mentioned before, this is going to be more of a Nintendo-focused podcast, but I will talk about games not on Nintendo hardware too. I am one of the elite few that owns a PS5 in Japan, so I should play it every now and then. After the game showcase, I'll run down the news with a focus on Japan. I also want to highlight unique merch that's only available here during these segments. Prepare for a lot of Pokemon talk, and things like a $10,000 Dragon Quest watch. Following the news is a feature discussing some gaming cultural elements of Tokyo or Japan. In today's episode, I'm going to introduce the best retro arcade in Tokyo. Best is maybe strong, but it's at least my favorite. If you want to play an original Pac-Man arcade cabinet, they have it, along with a lot of other awesome retro titles. In the future, I'll have features discussing topics like the Nintendo store in Shibuya, shopping for Pokemon cards in Tokyo, gaming cafes, and so on. Hopefully, I can help out somebody who is planning to come to Tokyo. I'll end each episode introducing a Japanese word or phrase related to gaming. Japan has its own unique gaming lexicon that's pretty fun to dig through. I'll then highlight a great tweet I found from a Japanese user on Twitter and close out the show. That was kind of a long intro, but hey, it's episode one. Sorry for the announcer voice, I'll try to use a normal human voice from here on out. No promises though. I'm very excited to share my passion for gaming with everyone. I'm solo for now, but I'm currently working on getting guests sooner than later, so please look forward to that. In today's episode, I'll be talking about the Switch's big November releases. Shin Megami Tensei V, which takes place in Tokyo, by the way. Pokemon Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl, and Animal Crossing Happy Home Paradise. I'll then dig into some recent news and do a deep dive on the best retro arcade in Tokyo. Let's get started! Shin Megami Tensei V, the latest post-apocalyptic demon-fighting and friending JRPG from Atlus. Sony has Persona, Nintendo gets Shin Megami Tensei, except for that one time they didn't. They like to keep these two franchises pretty separate most of the time. PS2 is still your go-to platform if you want both on the same hardware. This game was actually announced at Nintendo's big January event all the way back in 2017, so it's been nearly 5 years from announcement to release. Like Bayonetta 3, it was one of those titles where the developer said, "It's happening, don't worry." But we go years without any sort of updates. But it's real, and out, and quite good. I think I am one of the few people who have actually played more Shin Megami Tensei than Persona. I've only touched Persona 3, but I have played Shin Megami Tensei 3 through 5, and even a bit of 2 on the Super Famicom Nintendo Switch Online app. It's a very fascinating series. The setting and tone are very different from your typical JRPG. Post-apocalyptic Tokyo is the elevator pitch, but their take on the apocalypse is even then very unique and eerie. The combat is also great as someone who loves classes and customization in JRPGs. The mixing and matching of different demons to min-max skills and abilities really lets you build a unique team that suits how you want to play, or to maximize your effectiveness against a certain boss. A lot of people say it's a monster collecting RPG, which is sort of true in a sense, but there's no incentive to quote-unquote catch them all. And your monsters are actually quite disposable and just serve to be ingredients for a bigger, badder monster as you progress through the game. You aren't playing minigames to build up your friendship. You aren't walking around with them in a flower park. They're there just to get through the day. Obviously, I picked this title to be the first game I talk about because it takes place in Tokyo. The first shot is Shinagawa Station, which is one of the busiest in Tokyo, if not the country, if not even the world. It has that very expansive walkway that's often filled with throngs of people. It is a very typical, look at how crowded Tokyo is type of locale. Shinagawa Station also has some great food. I recommend the udon place, and there's a very cheap donburi restaurant as well. You stand and eat, so it's perfect if you're on the go. Anyways, the silent protagonist is a high school student in Tamachi, not far from the station. You get a bit of time to walk around the school and meet the supporting cast, and then you're thrown into the demon-infested apocalypse. The storytelling structure feels a bit like in between 3 and 4. SMT3 was almost infamously minimalistic in its story. You would play for 5 hours for a 30-second cutscene where little happened and even less was explained. It was purposefully ambiguous and reserved. Shin Megami Tensei 4 was almost the complete opposite, where there was a large supporting cast with their own storylines and more frequent cutscenes. It was very much a modern JRPG in how it presented its story and characters. SMT5 mimics the isolation of 3, but still has the story flow of 4. It's definitely a far cry from Persona, although I think the SMT versus Persona comparison game is a bit played out, but you gotta compare it at least once. It's podcast law. The biggest change from the past titles is that SMT5 focuses a lot more on exploration. The previous games were closer to dungeon crawlers, but instead of elaborate maze-like dungeons, you are now exploring wide open expanses and searching for nooks and crannies while picking up treasure and side quests. It's not quite open world, though. Think of it as very large hub areas, with different routes that gradually open up. I've also seen some comparisons to Xenoblade, though I don't think the number of enemies is quite as much as in Xenoblade. The first area is a glimmering desert around Tokyo Tower, where you explore dilapidated buildings and rolling dunes. It's a very visceral and atmospheric place. It's not a very typical opening area for a JRPG. Like most modern JRPGs, monsters are visible on the field. They're pretty well integrated into the setting. I went into this cave and all these creepy demons were hanging around like bats until they decided to attack me. It feels like a real world and not just a collection of mobs. Another thing that really helps is that the exploration often feels rewarding. When you come across a well-hidden treasure box, it likely has something of real value. I rarely feel like I've just found something that is going to sit in my inventory. Instead, it's items that could have a major impact on how I build my team. You can see the treasure icon on the map, but getting there can be a bit tricky. But that's part of the fun as well. There's even a bit of platforming involved, something I never expected in SMT. There are a lot of hidden and optional areas that hide special demons or useful items. In the opening desert, you can easily spend the first 10 hours here alone and still not get everything done. I'm in the second area now, and without getting into big spoilers, the later areas seem similar in their execution. Before you enter the second large area, the gameplay is broken up by going into smaller, more linear sections of the game, which diversifies the gameplay, but I do love exploring these bigger areas. Oh, and when you come across an incline, you can do this slide down the sand, which is pointless, but still pretty cool. The areas also have some side quests, but they are nothing special. However, the rewards for doing them are quite good. They are worth doing even though they are very fetch questy, like defeat 5 of a specific type of demon. It's not retroactive either, so even if you fought a lot of monsters, you have to do it again to fulfill the request. Some of these stories surrounding the quest are a bit funny, and one was interesting in that it had a branching path where you have to kind of choose which demon's request you're going to fulfill. I feel like these are worth doing for the reward, but they are the weakest part of the field exploration. I haven't talked about the story yet, but the gist is that you're a high school student in Tokyo who is then transported to a post-apocalyptic version of Tokyo and merged with an entity known as Aogami to form the Nahobino, a very powerful guy. It's really not explained what you are outside of being super special. Nahobino, which is a fun word to say. Demons are trying to invade Tokyo and you've got to stop them, or you can join them, whichever you like. The law and chaos aspect, which the series is known for, is in this game as well, but I haven't come across any major decision regarding it yet. The setting is quite different from 3 and 4 because those games had a completely destroyed Tokyo, while 5 has two versions that you can kind of bounce between. I think it's impressive how the past three SMT games share the same conceptual setting, but executes it in a completely different way. The story is helped tremendously by the excellent presentation. The cutscenes are exciting and well-directed, with excellent music and animation. They're sparse, but once they happen, they're quite memorable, and I feel like I get more than enough exposition during each one. I always look forward to each one, especially after going quite a while only talking to demons. The popular press-turn battle system returns, where you get additional turns for landing critical or super effective hits. By super effective, I mean you hit the demon's elemental weakness. Even more so than Pokemon, exploiting these elemental weaknesses is incredibly important, as it does significantly more damage and gives you more turns before the enemy can even move. And since in SMT your entire team can easily be wiped out by a random mob, you want to be in a scenario where you can clear out the enemies before they even have their turn. Customizing your team to add in as many elemental attacks as you can is part of the fun. One new element to the press turn system is the Magatsuhi gauge that fills up during the battle. It's basically a limit break, and activating it allows certain buffs. The one you are given at the start allows all hits to be critical for one round, which is incredibly useful, as it basically gives each character two turns to attack for extra damage. You will unlock others, but some can only be used by certain species of demon. Honestly, the free crits is more than enough for me right now. It's a legitimate game changer in boss fights, and can clear tricky mobs out as well. Another new element are essences, which can fuse into the Nahobino, or other demons, to get new skills or affinities. Think of it like demon fusion from past games, but you don't lose your demon. This is very useful for boss fights, as you can transfer a demon's resistances to your main character. I knew this boss had force attacks because it destroyed me in one hit the first time, so I fused an essence to my guy that completely blocked force attacks. I think it's important to keep a good stock of essences just in case. It is a bit unusual to totally change your resistances and weaknesses, though. It suddenly makes random mobs way easier or much harder depending on your setup. The Nahobino can unlock miracles as well, which are passive buffs that range from giving you more space to keep demons on your team to improving your magic skills. This is what I really enjoy about the series. The game gives you so much freedom in how you build your character, and you can really change it up easier than ever before. Demon fusion is basically the same, but now you have reverse compendium fusions, which let you fuse from any demon you've ever had. So you don't have to keep them in your team to fuse them. So please fuse away. You should be getting as many demons as possible for future fusions. I haven't had any fusion accidents or anything crazy happen yet, but I've definitely heard of stories where people got way stronger demons than expected. And the summon animation is excellent. I won't spoil it. Though if you have zero interest in playing this game, look it up on YouTube. The demons are basically there to be turned into something else, which is a bit sad if you really like one. I had to take this mermaid off my team even though I really loved the animation for her special attack, and she was so useful for much of the game. But that's SMT though, you can't get attached. I am looking forward to Jack Frost, of course. I've got Jack-O-Lantern on my team right now, and he's really useful, but you gotta go for the real Jack. Outside of fusion, you get demons by talking to them in battles. This is another classic SMT staple that is both loved and reviled since it can be a bit random. The conversations are really funny and often fourth wall breaking. It's hard to explain, but you can kind of get a sense of the personality of each demon, sometimes just by looking at them, and you can steer conversations towards them joining you. If the same demon is on your team, the enemy will escape. You won't get any XP, but you might get items, and you are spared a bit of combat if you're low on health or time. The exploration really scratches the open world portion of my brain, and the battle system is as great as ever, so I am really drawn into this game. It is quite difficult, but you can switch between easier modes at any time. They sell a lot of money or EXP DLC, but just skip that and turn down the difficulty. Nobody will judge you here. Also, if you want the Japanese voices on the US or PAL version of the game, you have to download that from the eShop for free. If you like party customization and JRPGs, and want something different from your typical fantasy setting, and want to see Tokyo landmarks, I think Shin Megami Tensei 5 is a great pickup. Hopefully the game stays this strong until the end. I'll keep you updated. Speaking of collecting monsters, Pokemon Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl was released a few days ago. These are the remakes of Pokemon Diamond and Pearl, which released on the DS in Japan in 2006. These are the Gen 4 Pokemon games, if you're not counting. For the first time ever, they are not developed internally by Game Freak, since that team is focusing on Pokemon Legends Arceus. Instead, they handed off development to the little-known Tokyo-based developer Ilka, which has until now mostly just provided development support. They have worked on some big titles, though, like Dragon Quest XI and both Nier games. But for them to suddenly be given the role as the primary developer for the Diamond and Pearl remakes, one of the highest-selling Pokemon games, is pretty surprising. This definitely seems like a someone at Game Freak knew someone at Ilka because they go to the same Izakaya together type of situation. Ilka did work on Pokemon Home, though. And also, Ilka is supposed to be Iruka, which means dolphin in Japanese, so there is a Nintendo tie-in there, right? I think a lot of people were expecting the Gen 4 remakes to use the Sword and Shield engine, or be similar to the Let's Go titles, but they feel quite different from both. We have three very different Pokemon RPGs on the Switch now. Now, there was a lot of controversy surrounding this game because of the art style and for its devotion to the original Diamond and Pearl titles instead of Platinum or focusing on new elements. I agree with a lot of these points, but so far I am really enjoying the game. Now, I love Gen 4. Pokemon Diamond, Pearl, and Platinum, or however you want to arrange it, is legitimately one of my favorite games of all time. So I was very much looking forward to a remake and had high expectations. Needless to say, I was pretty disappointed that they didn't give it a lot of love on the graphics front, and that it seemed to be a very by-the-numbers remake, instead of expanding on the game like the past Pokemon remakes. But the core gameplay is still there, and it's great, and I am digging a lot of the new additions as well. First, let's get the graphics out of the way. I still don't like this art style. It reminds me of this toy line in Japan called Pokemon Kids, which are these very cheap rubber toys of chibi Pokemon and trainers that you can buy at the grocery store. You look at something like Link's Awakening and this, and you can see that it's possible to capture the feeling of the original and keep it very chibi-ish while still making it look visually striking. I suppose they are just trying to translate the DS graphics faithfully into 3D and that's it. Sometimes I feel like it works, like how the trainer poses are the same as the original titles, but otherwise the game is certainly not a looker. Though I think a lot of people forgot, even the original Diamond and Pearl were criticized heavily for the graphics and overall art style. Many said it was too similar to the GBA. I think the colors also look a bit washed out. Maybe there will be areas later in the game that look impressive. I will say that the game does run well. There's no slowdown or chugging when in the field or in battles. I suppose that is one positive aspect of the very simple graphics. The music, though, is quite good. I love the Root renditions and Eterna City, but the Jubilife City remix is kind of so-so. Like the graphics, the feature set is also perhaps too faithful to the original DS games. There is almost no Platinum content outside of some forms you unlock later in the game. I really don't understand the aversion to mixing things up in these remakes. They want to preserve nostalgia, but I don't think anyone is nostalgic about the exact number and levels of Pokemon on Route 203. I'm all for throwing in a Gible at 1% in there somewhere to spice things up. It's interesting to see what new mechanics they've included and what they've taken out. For example, you do unlock the ability to access the PC from anywhere, like in Sword and Shield. However, TMs break like they do in the original titles. They somewhat balance this by giving you multiple TMs. Gym leaders will give you 5 of a TM instead of 1. This is kind of a strange compromise. I know the original games were not designed with infinite TM use in mind, but who cares? Let us use an infinite number of grass knots. I assure you it won't ruin the game. I think Diamond and Pearl is easily the most difficult set of games to remake for today. It was very groundbreaking at the time, and part of its legacy is that it introduced so many important elements into the series. For one, the dual screen setup. I think people don't realize that until the Switch, most of Pokemon's lifespan was on dual-screen hardware. It had the classic JRPG DS setup, with the combat on the top and the menu on the bottom. This seems quite quaint now, but it was awesome to see for the first time back in the day. You can clearly see the battlefield with your menus in a completely separate area. BDSP mimics this somewhat by keeping the same big colorful blocks for the battle menu. The Pokétech also took advantage of the dual-screen setup. Fortunately, the Pokétech is back, and it looks the same as it did in the DS games, which is in line with the rest of the game being incredibly faithful to the original titles. You can keep it on your screen permanently, but it does take up a big section of the screen, so most of the time it's smarter to turn it off. It's just not the same as having it always on the bottom screen. But I have found myself playing around in it. You've got to use that calculator, of course. Diamond and Pearl were also the first Pokemon games to have online features, which are commonplace today, but were hugely important at the time. You could trade and battle online. That was a pipe dream before the DS games. The Global Trade Station allowed you to trade with randoms online. Yeah, it was a bit broken because a lot of people were asking for legendaries, but I made dozens of useful trades using the GTS. Now the GTS has been replaced by the Global Wonder Station, which allows wonder trades. I love wonder trades, but I strongly dislike how they've moved the GTS function to the phone app. Wireless local communication was also a great addition to the original games. It made connecting with people next to you easier than ever. No one needed a clumsy cable. If you had the game, you could play with others. I have some good memories of trading with friends and exploring the underground together. Anyways, Gen 4 had a lot of features that were ahead of its time and can't be duplicated today, which kind of lessens the appeal of these titles. That said, I still think the core Gen 4 gameplay is amazing. Sinnoh is a wonderfully realized region with so many places to explore and incredible secrets to find. If you love catching legendaries, this game is for you. The overworld is one of the best, if not the best, in the entire series, as it's filled with puzzles, optional areas, and hidden sections. And BDSP captures that well. It's endearingly retro at times. The dialogue is far more blunt and direct than it is today, which is charming in a way. There are also a lot more trainers, who actually have more than two Pokemon. Even the first real rival battle can wipe you out if you're not careful. It has a different pacing and design philosophy compared to Gen 8, which might suit those who didn't enjoy that game. It's always a bit scary to replay games you love that you haven't touched in years. Does it really hold up? Will the cracks start to show? Should I just let nostalgia take over? Like I mentioned before, it's difficult to capture what made Diamond and Pearl great in many ways, but the gameplay experience is strong enough to still be enjoyable today. BDSP did add to the original side content, namely the contests and the underground. I haven't tried out the contest yet, but they seem to focus more on the rhythm game portion than before. I have spelunked to the underground though, and honestly, it's better than ever. I love the underground in the original game. It's such a weird thing to add to a Pokemon game, but it's easy to lose yourself into it. If you've never tried it, you basically enter a complex series of tunnels where you play a Minesweeper-like minigame to dig for items. Some are gems that you can trade for other items, while others are things like fossils, held items, and things you can sell for money. The minigame is simple, but very fun, and yes, there is some strategy involved. You can also set up a secret base. Unlike in Gen 3, these are less complex, and are mostly places to house statues of Pokemon you find that can affect the type of Pokemon that appear in the underground. Ilka added these new grottos to the underground that are filled with Pokemon, some that you can only find here or find much earlier than you would above ground. I was lucky enough to catch a Togepi here, which you could only find in the original game with PokéRadar. Surprisingly, these Pokemon are actually quite tough, and they were a higher level than my team, so I wasn't able to catch most of them. You can play the underground online and see other players, but you can't really interact with them. They added a point system where if you rack up enough points by finding Diglets, you are given a buff to find rarer items, and the shiny rate goes up as well. Getting these points is repetitive playing solo, but if you play online, everyone's points are added together, so it's much easier. I'll definitely be jumping back into the underground every now and then to see what I can find. This is not my dream Gen 4 remake, but the essentials are there, so I'm looking forward to reliving a lot of classic moments from the original game. I am going to one-hit KO all of Cynthia's Pokemon. I'm calling my shot here. If you've never played Gen 4, I think this is an easy recommendation. Or if you were burned by Sword and Shield and want a more classic experience, this is it. Oh, and I picked Turtwig, by the way. I can't fault anyone for picking Chimchar or Piplup, though. I think this set is easily one of the best group of starters. The countdown to me getting Earthquake starts now. The last new game I want to talk about is Animal Crossing Happy Home Paradise and the 2.0 update, which hit a few weeks ago. Although Animal Crossing never ends, the new content has been out for about 2 weeks, and I feel like I've seen what the update has to offer. Happy Home Paradise is the paid DLC content for Animal Crossing, which focuses more on decorating spaces and is similar to Happy Home Designer on the 3DS. Now, I ended up skipping Happy Home Designer because the concept of solely designing homes didn't seem enough to warrant a $40 purchase. That title received a lot of mixed reviews, but I did hear from some that while the game was pretty aimless, it was still fun and cathartic to design homes. When Nintendo announced they were essentially putting that game into New Horizons as DLC, I wasn't very excited. I don't come to Animal Crossing solely for designing, and I am not some pro interior or exterior decorator. For me, part of the fun of designing your home is utilizing what you have in creative ways. You've got a freezer, you've got a bamboo candle, you've got a treadmill, try to figure something out. Just getting a huge inventory to play with didn't seem like it would be my thing. That said, it's totally my thing now. I'm very surprised at how much I'm digging Happy Home Paradise. While it has more structure than the core Animal Crossing game, it still captures the free and relaxing feeling of the series. It's more open than I thought it would be, and it's really up to the player to determine the pacing. The DLC is framed as you going to work for a vacation resort company run by Lottie, who was in the Happy Home Designer game. Newcomers include the monkey Nico, which might be the smallest Animal Crossing character, and Wardell, a nearly mute manatee who will obviously become your new favorite character. You are employed at the company where you talk to animals who hang out on the beach and then design their dream vacation home. Nintendo has taken off the leash and given players an incredible amount of raw design power. You choose the setting, like the season and the time of day, the home exterior, and of course the inside. Each animal you help requests a specific theme. These themes are very diverse, with some simple ones like a reading room or a dollhouse, or they get a bit wild, like an extravagant bathroom or an ice palace. Each house has about 2 or 3 requested items, but outside of those, you are free to decorate it however you want. As long as you have the required items, you cannot fail, and there is no scoring system. I've seen some people complain that there are no real consequences or rewards for designing a specific way, but for me, that is a major strength. I don't want to be punished for my creativity. I don't want to be punished for being ahead of my time. I just want to play and have fun. After designing each home, you're rewarded with Poki, which is the currency exclusive to the vacation resort. And you can purchase exclusive items there as well. If you buy something on the island, you can buy it again via Bells through the Nook catalog, so definitely buy whatever you want. The open and free structure is perhaps the greatest part of the game. You can spend 5 minutes on a house, or you can spend an hour. I always try to make the design as close to the theme as possible. I'm not trying to cheese anything. Each home has order items, which closely match the theme, but you can also use items you've used in past vacation homes you've designed. So as you design more and more homes, you get more items at your disposal. So don't feel like you have to use only the order items. Use whatever you want. One great feature is that you can instantly open up the customization menu for the items by pressing X. There are so many items that I never knew had customization options. It really makes me want to dig into my inventory. Like I said earlier, you can also heavily customize the exterior, such as the house design, and put trees and other items outside. I always try to make the house close to the interior theme. If the animal wants a traditional Japanese home, I of course pick the castle or the thatched roof hut. I always try to make the color of the exterior the same color as the animal. I assume if animals could make their own home, they would want it to be the color of their fur or feathers. There are hundreds of new items, and the DLC is the fastest way to see those firsthand. One of my favorites so far is the home for Cephalobot, which is this robot octopus. He wants a sci-fi home, and you get access to so many wild items, like these complicated machines and stasis pods. It's easily one of the coolest looking houses I've designed so far. I always thought the robot animals were a little creepy, but if they are quarantined in their own vacation home, it's fine. Now the real highlight are the facilities. After you design a set number of homes, you will get to decorate buildings on the island. The first one is a school, and at this time you will also unlock the ability to change the size of the room. These are the biggest areas yet, and you can easily spend an hour decorating just one place. Even within a set theme, there are so many different items that let you narrow in on a theme. For the school, you can create a kindergarten or a university. It can be classic or modern. You can have an English-themed classroom or a science one. It gets even crazier when you get to the other facilities. The restaurant allows you to design the main area and the kitchen. Of course, I designed a Japanese restaurant, but you can make a diner, a family restaurant, a pizza place, whatever you want. I've been looking at some other players' designs online, and I am constantly blown away by how specific you can theme these areas. This may sound a bit silly, but they almost feel like the closest thing Animal Crossing has to a boss battle. Oh, and the animals you helped out earlier work at these facilities, which is pretty adorable. Genji is my Japanese chef. Of course, there can be no other. Designing homes is really peaceful in a way. You're not rushed. You're not trying to min-max anything for a score. You can do whatever you want to do. Some people may be off-put by the lack of any gamification or score, but it offers a chill experience for those who want to be creative, without conflicts or limits. If you are bell poor like I am, there is a novelty to having access to hundreds and hundreds of absurdly weird and expensive items that you normally wouldn't have in the main game. I think as a standalone title, this game wouldn't work as well, but as DLC, it's really perfect. It offers a unique experience that still ties in a major gameplay element with the overall vibe of the game. And that's just Happy Home Paradise. Nintendo also released a huge 2.0 update for free. Animal Crossing fans have been waiting for this for probably over a year now. Many people expected it in March, since at that point a year has passed and it would be perfect timing for a big year 2 update. But we got Mario items and then radio silence for many months. But it's finally here. There are so many new additions, but I'll just touch on my favorites. Brewster's Cafe, The Roost, is back as part of the museum. Like the past games, the interactivity is pretty low, but thankfully they brought back Brewster's very detailed and specific animations. As you talk to him each day and grow closer, you unlock more coffee customization options. One of the best new additions that you can get is coffee to go. You get a little cup and everything. This is one of the many things that, on paper, sounds incredibly mundane, but in Animal Crossing, it is borderline groundbreaking. If you own any amiibo cards, the cafe becomes much more interesting, as you can invite guests, including characters that aren't in the game. I have a Gracie amiibo card, so I can see her, and she actually invites LaBelle, of course. Brewster, like hopefully everyone, loves gyroids, and they are perhaps my favorite 2.0 addition. In the past games, they were all kind of the same shape, just a bit taller or more stout. Now they have completely unique designs and appearances. Some are similar to the original gyroids, but others have more bizarre appearances. One looks like Mr. Saturn, another kind of looks like a Korok. They are all fantastically weird in their own way. Their movement is also very different from each other. My favorite is Twangoid, which has a kind of a harp for a mouth that it strums. Another is Drumoid, which can play its body like a drum with cymbals. You can also change their colors, so even if you have a few of the same type, you can still make them look very different. They are smaller than before, which is a good thing, since you can place them on furniture or on walls. Gyroids were one of the biggest missing pieces for me, so I'm glad that they're back and better than ever. My only complaint is I wish they were real. I know gyroids are based off of Haniwa, which are these ancient terracotta statues, but those don't move, and they don't sing. You can get the gyroids after it rains, or by planting and watering gyroid fragments that you get from Cap'n Island tours. And yes, Cap'n is back. Similar to the Nook Mile tours, he takes you to far-off islands where you can get new materials. But Cap'n's islands are way better. They have rarer items like star fragments, and there is a chance that you visit an island in a different season or a time of day, which can really help fill out your seasonal recipes or your Critterpedia. I've visited winter and summer islands in fall, so it is quite useful if you've missed a month or two. Harv's Island also replaces the shopping street in the past games. There are 7 shops you can create, and they cost 100k each to set up, so you're looking at 700k out of your pocket to get everything finished. These are permanent shops that you can visit every day, so you don't need to wait for a certain character to visit your island. There's Katrina's Fortune Teller booth, Sahara's rugs and wallpaper. Tortimer also reappears to give storage access and give out some seasonal items. Cyrus and Reese can customize your furniture that you can't do yourself, like the Nook Miles items. Leaf sells botanical goods, Kicks shoes, and perhaps the biggest addition is Red sets up a mini shop that sells artwork. Only 2 pieces, and yes, sometimes they are all fake, but it's much easier to fill out your museum than it was before. He also sells random items you can hold via a raffle. I recommend buying a few to see what you get. Harriet is also there, and she teaches you new hairstyles. Cyrus and Reese's customization shop, and of course, Red's art, are the biggest highlights. Honestly, you can ignore Katrina. If you get bad luck from her, it can affect the island cap'n visits. So either visit the island before or just don't talk to her. Another huge feature is cooking. You now have access to sugar, wheat, tomatoes, potatoes, carrots, and of course pumpkins as well. There are dozens of recipes, and the food items are wonderfully detailed. I can see this being the main focus of the update for many players. You can get the seeds from Leaf and plant them on your island exactly like how pumpkins work. Sadly, there doesn't seem to be any okonomiyaki you can make, which was my most wanted food item. Maybe next time. Other than that, there's certainly a huge variety of dishes you can make. You can also mix in existing items like fish and mushrooms. You will be surprised at the type of ingredients you can use. There are even turnip dishes. I also really love the new camera options, especially the handheld camera, which lets you walk around in first person. This opens up so many new photo opportunities and is especially fantastic when you take photos of the vacation homes you designed in the DLC. It's very funny that New Horizons briefly feels like a FPS when you're walking around. I think a major theme of the 2.0 update is giving players more freedom than ever before. With the new shopping area and Cabin's Islands, it's much easier to get hard-to-find items or mats. I think Nintendo feels, okay, players have had a year of playing Animal Crossing for real. Let's let them bend the rules a bit and get what they want. I think with the 2.0 update, New Horizons has finally satisfied, I want to say, 99% of the user base. I do still think the dialogue options with the animals are a bit lacking compared to New Leaf, and there are some missing furniture sets I'd like to return, but everything else works wonderfully, and the new ideas they introduced in New Horizons completely makes you rethink how you interact with the game. If you haven't played in a while, I would certainly recommend hopping in and poking around a bit to see if any of the new additions might hook you. Oh, and of course, the best froggy chair is the light blue one. That's it for games. Definitely a lot of exciting titles to play on Switch this month. Let's hop into the news. All right, let's talk about some news. I hope you like sales figures and Pokemon merch, because that's a big chunk of it. But there are some new game announcements I also want to touch on. Nintendo released their most recent financial reports for the quarter ending on September 30th a few weeks ago, with the Switch hitting 92.87 million units sold worldwide. I think it's quite likely that they surpassed the Wii's 101 million lifetime units this holiday. I remember when President Kimishima said that he expected the Switch to sell as well as the Wii before it launched, which was certainly a bold statement, but history is going to prove him right. It's not a prediction a lot of people were making in early 2017. Software sales were equally as strong. The best-selling Switch game, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, now sits at 38.74 million units, which makes it the best-selling Mario Kart SKU ever, even passing Mario Kart Wii. The Wii U and the Switch versions combined passed it a while ago, but now we can say that the Switch version alone is the definitive best-selling Mario Kart. Everyone wants Mario Kart 9, but it's easy to see why Nintendo is happy just to let this game coast towards millions and millions of units sold each quarter. Animal Crossing New Horizons is at second place with 34.85 million. It looked like New Horizons had a legitimate chance of passing Mario Kart, and while Animal Crossing is still selling extremely well, Mario Kart is Mario Kart. Smash passed 25 million, Breath of the Wild is almost at 25 million, with Pokemon trailing a bit at 22 million. It will probably pass Gold and Silver, which sold 23 million pretty soon, making Sword and Shield the second best-selling Pokemon games. Ring Fit Adventure has hit 12.21 million units, making it the best-selling JRPG outside of Pokemon. Yes, it is a JRPG, except you have the stats. For newer titles, Skyward Sword HD sold about 3.6 million units, meaning it has almost surpassed the original game's lifetime sales in just 3 months. I feel like there wasn't a whole lot of interest around this re-release, but Breath of the Wild made a lot of new Zelda fans, and you're seeing great results from the sales of Link's Awakening and now Skyward Sword. Mario Golf Super Rush is a bit under 2 million, and Miitopia has passed 1.3 million. New Pokemon Snap is a weird case, as it's listed as 2.19 million excluding Japan. That's because the Pokemon Company publishes this game in Japan, not Nintendo, so the sales aren't reported. Based on the physical sales reports from Japan, you could maybe say it sold about a million. So new Pokemon Snap being around 3 million isn't that crazy of a guess. So if you put games on the Switch, they will probably sell well. We're really living in the golden age of Nintendo in terms of game quality and also market interest, so I love seeing so many great titles get their due. For the next quarter, everyone is anticipating Metroid Dread's sales figures. For Metroid fans, passing 2 million is the magic number to make it the best-selling Metroid title of all time, and I think it has a very solid chance of hitting that this quarter alone. Nintendo announced that the US October Dread sales were around 845,000, so 2 million worldwide this quarter, not impossible. There's also a lot of interest around the OLED sales. There were so many rumors of a Switch Pro hitting this year, and the OLED announcement was kind of a tepid one, but I think enough people are hungry for an upgrade. Yet there is still a global chip shortage that is affecting stock, and Nintendo did lower their sales target a bit. The Switch is selling phenomenally, but it's a bit wild to imagine that it could be selling even more if there wasn't a chip shortage. The next sales update will be around February, and I'll be digging into that as well. For Japan sales, this past week saw Shin Megami Tensei V debut at number 1, with 143,000 sales. The physical sales are a bit under 3 and 4, but with digital, I would say it's a solid debut. All Switch hardware has sold 87,000 this week, which is a bit under last week. Switch is at 4.5 million units sold for 2021 in Japan, which is under 4.65 million units at this point last year. A lot of people were speculating whether or not 2020 or 2021 would have higher hardware sales. While it seems obvious 2020 would easily top this year at first, there were many strong weeks for 2021, and it was outpacing last year. However, it looks like the overall hardware sales in Japan will be a bit under last year, but still nothing to complain about. The OLED is still a supply restraint. I constantly see it out of stock here. It seems to have better stock than PS5 at least. Last bit about Japanese game sales. Famitsu did a 20th anniversary article on Xbox recently, where they highlighted the best-selling Xbox games in Japan. I came across this data thanks to Game Data Library's Twitter account, which is a must-follow, so please check them out. I won't go through the entire list, so go to @GameDataLibrary to see it, but I want to talk about the top sellers. For the original Xbox, the best-selling game is Dead or Alive 3 at 217,000, which was a big get back in the day. And Dead or Alive Extreme Beach Volleyball is at second place with 127,000. Halo is number 3. It's pretty fun to see Tecmo dominate these charts with DOA and Ninja Gaiden, but that was the Japanese game developer for the original Xbox. 360, which was the most successful piece of Xbox hardware in Japan, has Star Ocean: The Last Hope as the best-selling title at 208,000. That's a bit surprising for me, as I expected Tales of Vesperia to outsell it, but that's at number 2. Beautiful Katamari rounds out the list at number 10, which is fun to see. For Xbox One, the best-selling game is Titanfall, believe it or not. Great game, but not best-selling game ever type of material. It sold 43,000 units, a far cry from the top sellers of the past. There's only one Japanese game developed here, which is Dead Rising 3. Series X is exceeding expectations in Japan, and Game Pass could make an impact over here, so I think Xbox could bounce back from the complete non-factor they were during the Xbox One days in Japan. Some new games were announced. Namco surprised everyone with, now let me get this title right, Dragon Ball The Breakers. I wish the name leaked a day before so I could see what everyone's reaction was. I want to see them try to guess what kind of game could this be. I think nobody would have guessed async multiplayer survival game. Basically, it's Dead by Daylight, but with Dragon Ball characters. Or Evolve, or Friday the 13th, the video game, whichever you prefer. 7 people are civilians, and one character is the Raider, which is a big, powerful enemy. If you're the civilian, you try to survive. If you're the Raider, you try to wipe everyone out. The survivors are your typical Dragon Ball characters you would see in the background of the show. I'm not sure if it's just like a pig or if it is Oolong, but you can play as either Oolong or a pig. The Raiders are the big Dragon Ball bosses like Frieza or Cell. The Dragon Ball setting is pretty interesting for this type of game, and it allows for a lot of fun abilities and scenarios, so it could hook people who are not really in the horror aesthetic. It is worth noting that Dead by Daylight is fairly popular in Japan, so I wouldn't be surprised if some Namco devs are really into that game and wanted to make their own version. It's coming to every platform, including Switch, in early 2022. Not content with just that, Namco also announced Pac-Man Museum Plus for all platforms. It's, you guessed it, a Pac-Man game collection. Now stay with me here as I run through them. Pac-Man, Super Pac-Man, Pac-and-Pal, Pac-Land, Pac-Mania, Pac-Attack, Pac-in-Time, Pac-Man Arrangement Arcade and CS Versions, Pac-Man Championship Edition, Pac-Motos, Pac-and-Roll Remix, Pac-Man Battle Royale, and Pac-Man 256. Okay, that's a lot of Pac-Man games. Pac-Man Championship Edition is the standout for me. 2 was available on the Switch, but not 1. So soon both will be. There's certainly a lot of obscure titles here, so it looks like a solid collection for Pac-Man fans. However, if you just want to play the original Pac-Man, you can play it on Switch already. Multiple ways. I own Namco Museum, which has arcade Pac-Man, but there's also Arcade Archives Pac-Man from Hamster, and the Namco Museum Archives Volume 1, which has the NES Famicom Pac-Man. That game, by the way, is Namcot Collection in Japan, which has both Archives Volume 1 and 2, so technically you could have 4 different ways to launch Pac-Man on the Switch, and soon 5 with this new collection. It comes out early 2022. By the way, Pac-Man Versus on Namco Museum is great, so please play it. Let's get into the Pokemon section. I actually had to cut out some Pokemon news because there's so much of it. For Pokemon cards, the VMAX Climax set hits Japan on December 3rd. It's a huge 190-card set, with the highlights being trainer art cards with their signature Pokemon. There's a really cool one with Red and the Gigantamax Pikachu. There's also VMAX and even V-Union reprints in this set, so it's a good way to catch up if you've missed out on the past sets. Another unique element is that each booster pack will come with 11 cards, instead of the typical 5, and one is guaranteed to be rare. In Japan, boosters are not guaranteed a rare, which can sound like a bummer, but on average, you are more likely to get a rare card more frequently than in the States. Also, since boosters are only 5 cards here, they are half the price, so they are a very dangerous impulse buy. However, the Pokemon card situation in Japan is insane, to say the least. If you want to get new sets, you need to win online lotteries or pay extra to scalpers. I'm definitely going to have a feature about Pokemon card shopping in Tokyo in a future episode. I promise it will be interesting even if you don't like Pokemon cards. It is a very fascinating subject looking from the outside in. Speaking of Pokemon, Mr. Donut has a new Pokemon campaign to line up with the Gen 4 remakes. The classic Pikachu head shaped donut returns. I had the Pikachu one and it's okay. It has kind of a pudding flavor. I really don't like the donuts with cream in them though, which is bad news for me since all these new donuts have cream in them. Now stay with me here as I explain the new ones. The new donuts are the backside of Pikachu and Eevee and Piplup. I don't know why you would want to eat this, but it's available for you. They all have cream in them though, so beware. Decidueye is also now available in Pokemon Unite. That's a game I was really into for about a week and then dropped, but it seems to have a strong fan base and the developers have been doing a great job at least putting out content. They often seem to have new characters at a pretty frequent pace. I can't say there's any specific mon they could add that would get me back into the game. They also added a lot of costumes, but again, I feel like there's no costume that has amazed me so far. Charizard has one with a scarf and beanie. I mean, that's okay, but they're really just throwing darts to decide who wears what. What if Blastoise wore a tuxedo? Sure, put it in the game. There's also a 120-centimeter plushie of Lucario, so 4 feet. You can pre-order now, but it goes on sale in May 2022. There are some very creepy promo photos of this thing, but it's hard not to take a creepy photo of a giant Lucario plushie. It's available for the low price of 46,200 yen, or about $450, so about $100 a foot. Also, there's a Kirby pop-up shop at Ariake Garden Gallery in Odaiba until Sunday, November 28th. It looks like your typical Kirby merch and plushies that you would see in Japan. Ironically, the coolest thing is the tables are shaped like the blocks in Kirby. Kirby actually has quite a few pop-up shops with different themes. I remember a train theme was quite popular a few years ago. Of course, Yamashiroya is the go-to place for Kirby merch, a place I would detail in an upcoming feature. That's it for news. By the way, any merch I talk about will be posted on the post for this episode on my website, tokyogamelife.com, in case you actually want to see what I'm talking about. Now, for this episode's feature about my favorite retro or perhaps favorite arcade in all of Tokyo. The This episode's feature is about the best retro arcade in Tokyo. When a lot of tourists come to Tokyo, they of course are drawn to the bigger, more modern arcades, or game centers as they are known in Japan. Places like the huge Sega arcades in Akihabara, or Taito's Game Station. These places of course are great, but they do feel a bit samey. They will always have the same group of rhythm games, they will always have Tekken 7, they will always have Taiko no Tatsujin. If you're visiting Tokyo, these places of course are worth visiting, but once you see them nearly every day, you want to spice things up. I want to be surprised when I go to an arcade, and of course, I'm drawn to retro games, since there is a novelty to playing an original Space Invaders machine in 2021. My pick for the best retro arcade in Tokyo is the Mikado Game Center in Takada no Baba. It's close to Takada no Baba Station, about two stops away from Shinjuku on the Yamanote Line. So it's incredibly easy to access if you're in Tokyo. Takada no Baba is apparently where Astro Boy is from, and there's actually huge graffiti murals of Tezuka's art around the station. There's countless restaurants, since there's a lot of language schools in the area, and students need a cheap place to eat. You can easily spend a lot of time here on a chill Sunday. It's a very well-known arcade in the city, and I think it earns its reputation. Although it's close to the station, it's tucked away on a street that most people wouldn't stroll down. It doesn't have any fancy entrance, and the sign is actually quite small. The main sign doesn't have any game aesthetic. It looks like it's written with calligraphy. Mikado feels like a place you would only find if you knew about it beforehand. It feels secret in a way, even though it's pretty popular. Even on the inside, it's not fancy. It feels like it could be any other building in Japan. Now that said, why is it my favorite retro arcade? Well, I think the number and variety of games here can't be beat. Stepping into the building, you're met with wall-to-wall arcade games. Last time I went there, I immediately saw Marble Madness, F-Zero AX, Daytona USA, Virtual On, Final Fight. There are dozens and dozens of classic arcade titles spanning every genre you can think of. If you're here for 2D fighters, you've got more than enough. Here for racers with gimmicky cabs, done, here you go. Do you want to play Mahjong Solitaire for hours? You can. I can't list every single classic arcade title I've seen here, but I'm sure in their inventory they have nearly everything of note. I've visited Mikado several times, and each time they've changed their layout and swapped out games. You'll go there and see a Luigi's Mansion arcade cabinet, and a few months later, when you visit, it'll be replaced by a Space Harrier. It can be a bit disappointing to return, only to see your favorite title swapped out. But for me, I'm always interested to see what kind of quote-unquote new games they have. Mikado is two floors. When you first enter, you'll be surrounded by arcade games with unique cabs. Stuff like OutRun or Afterburner, where you actually sit down to play. They also have some modern games like Gundam Extreme Versus 2, but the retro titles are far more numerous. The entrance is easily the most cramped, and if there's a lot of people there, you're going to have to squeeze. As you move towards the back and closer to the staircase, you'll see the bigger cabs, like a two-player Daytona USA one. They have quite a few two-player titles. In the back, there are about, I want to say, 40 Blast City cabs. Actually, if you go to their official site, they do have a floor plan posted so you can check out the layout. However, I don't think it's that accurate. Looking at it now, it was updated in July. However, I went in September and October, and even between those two visits, there were several games that were completely different. Honestly, it's more fun not to look it up beforehand. Anyways, if you don't know, Blast City was a multi-purpose arcade cab Sega made in the mid-90s. It was an update to their Astro City series. A lot of games are housed in these cabs, which give the arcade a very 90s retro feel. These cabs hold a lot of games that don't need unique hardware to play, such as puzzle games, shmups, beat-em-ups, etc. It's a bit strange to go to an arcade just to play Tetris, but I do love Grandmaster. Even these titles are switched out fairly frequently. I remember I wanted to play some Sailor Moon beat-em-up, but somebody was already using it, and the next time I went there, it was gone. I'm not a huge shmup fan, so I typically pass on Raiden or Gradius, but if Ikaruga is there, you gotta play Ikaruga. You're losing money if you don't play Ikaruga. There's something about that game that appeals to shmup newbies like myself. I think the concept of switching between black and white attacks is so simple, but very intense during gameplay. The second floor is almost entirely Astro City cabs, except there are some DDR machines in the back. According to the map layout, there's over 100 cabs here, 100. Now, if you came to flex your fighting game skills, this is the area for you. Pretty much every notable Japanese fighting game that has ever existed is here. Street Fighter, 2, Third Strike, Alpha 3, 4, and so on. KOF 94 to 2002. Virtual Fighter, Fatal Fury, Darkstalkers, even Bloody Roar. I don't want this section to be me just naming retro games, but you get the point. Except I do want to bring up Budiki 1. The first time I visited Mikado, I was specifically looking for a Budiki 1 cabinet to play, but I couldn't find it. However, when I went there about a month ago, it was suddenly there. Budiki 1 is a fighting game from SNK on their Ultra Neo Geo 64 hardware, their ill-fated attempt at a 64-bit arcade unit. Only 7 games came out on it, with Budiki 1 being the last one in May 99. These games are notoriously difficult to emulate, even on PC, and the only one that had a console release was Samurai Showdown 64, which was heavily retooled. So if you come across any Hyper Neo Geo 64 game, you kind of gotta play it for history's sake. The interesting thing about Budiki 1 is that it's a fighting game, but the control method is completely unique. There's no 6 or 4 button input. You attack with the stick, and you move with the left and right buttons. Left button, right button, stick. That's it. It's not flashy at all. It goes for a more grounded MMA style of fighting. Think Pride from the early 2000s. I might do a whole feature solely on Budiki 1 in the future, but the point is, you would be amazed at the type of games you can find at Mikado. I even found Crazy Kong, believe it or not. Since most of the fighting games are on the second floor, they'll often run tournaments up here. I've accidentally popped by in the middle of one. As a guest, it's kind of annoying since a lot of the machines are being used for the tourney, but it's cool to just stumble upon a video game tournament. There's a calendar on their website, and they seem to be constantly holding events. Now, while I said this was the best retro arcade, I'm going to cheat a little bit. Because Mikado is not just one building. Down the same street is another building Mikado manages, called Natsuge Museum. It's under the Mikado family, so I'm going to count it. While the main arcade focuses mostly on 90s and 2000s games, Natsuge Museum focuses more on 80s titles and has more pinball machines. Like the other Mikado Game Center, it has 2 floors, although these are much smaller and there's only a few games. Yet these are not in generic Astro City caps. They're in their original cabinets. Donkey Kong, Pac-Man, Space Invaders, Mappy, Xevious, and so forth are all available to play as they were when they originally came out. Some of these are actually quite cheap, only 50 yen to play. Now, be sure to put in only 50 yen and not 100 yen like I did, or else it will mess up the machine. Now, as a big Nintendo fan, of course, the highlights are Donkey Kong, with the original arcade art splashed across the sides, and they also have Arcade Punch-Out. The arcade version is neat because it has 2 monitors, with the top showing a scoreboard and the bottom showing the gameplay. I do feel like it's much more challenging than the NES title, though. Maybe I'm just bad at it. As I mentioned earlier, there are only a few pinball machines, and honestly, there's nothing really here to write home about. It's not like the Jurassic Park pinball is here or anything. They are very bare-bones pinball units. I have noticed that they sometimes move the pinball machines between the 2 game centers, which must be pretty annoying. If you're looking for an arcade to stop by in Tokyo, I can't think of a better one than Mikado Game Center in Takada no Baba. There's also a branch in Ikebukuro, but the quality and quantity of games doesn't match up. You gotta go for the real thing. And if you really have fun, you can buy quite a bit of merch there as well. They have a mascot girl who I would say is at least Miku adjacent. You can buy pin badges from a gashapon machine or a t-shirt. They also sell some more expensive items like OSTs for arcade games, but I recommend you save your yen and play the dozens and dozens of great arcade titles here. Mikado Game Center, check it out. Okay, let's get into our Japanese gaming word. This episode's word is sutege. Sutege. It combines the word suteru, which means to throw away, with geimu, which of course means game. Sutege literally means abandoned game, or maybe even throwaway game. Sutege describes a situation when somebody suddenly quits a game in the middle of it, especially at an arcade, where you just get up and leave while your game is still active. I guess it's similar to rage quit in English, but that implies anger, while sutege is more reserved. Like if you're trying to get a perfect score in a rhythm game, and you make a mistake, instead of going through with the rest of the song, you just kind of walk away and let the song play out. It can also refer to leaving in the middle of your run in a game because time got away from you and there are errands to run. Also, if you're playing competitively at an arcade and one person is destroying the other, the person, instead of taking their defeat, they just walk away. That is sutege. One last time, sutege. Now for the Japanese tweet of the episode, or the J-tote, as I like to call it. This is less of a specific tweet and more of a user. I like how I'm breaking my rules on episode one. Anyways, the user is Kajikomu or Kazikom. Kazi is a photographer that specializes in flat lay photography, where the photo is taken directly above the object. Kazi focuses on photographing old tech in these wonderfully framed and colorful photos. A common theme that Kazi will do is pick a year and then lay out tech or pop culture items from that year and take a shot. The 2001 photo has an original GBA, an instant camera, an Ayumi Hamasaki CD, a mobile phone from that era, and so on. These are definitely nostalgic time capsules, and even if you don't know a lot about Japanese pop culture from that era, you might be introduced to something new. My description is really underselling how fantastic these photos are. The link will be in the description, so don't worry about the spelling from now, but please check it out. Wow, thanks for listening. This is episode one, so I don't have any reader mail, but if you have a question you want answered, feel free to email me at tokyogamelife@gmail.com, all one word. If you just have a question or a comment in general about the podcast, feel free to share. Is my sound too scratchy? Did I mispronounce the demon's name wrong? I need to know. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and yes, I've even been trying out TikTok. So search for Tokyo Game Life on those platforms. I also have a website, tokyogamelife.com, with supplemental material for each episode. Just click on the post for any episode and you'll see additional information, especially pictures of the places I talk about. Right now, I have my personal photos of my trips to the Mikado Game Center, so please check it out. I'm aiming for a bi-weekly podcast, so the next episode will be Sunday, December 5th, JST. I'll be talking about a few very unique games, so please be excited. All right, thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. Matane!